This is Rescue Junkies podcast, episode number 2, with Chris Enright and Rowan McClune, talking about rescue-related stuff and everything else related to fire EMFs and basically doing good things for the public, I suppose.
Yes, sir. So we're going to start by talking about a pretty crazy technical rescue that we had in a neighboring district up here. On the North Table Mountain, there was a hiker who was crushed by a falling boulder. Her leg was pinned under this boulder. We had both the concerns of a kind of a rope rescue call plus a technical rescue, what you might encounter in an urban scenario, like a heavy extrication, that sort of thing. All combined, we had environmental issues. We had a lot of things going on at the time. So the hiker was trapped for several hours. They called for medevac through Flight for Life. And Flight for Life was not able to land pretty much anywhere near that scene. They had to land on the top of the Table Mountain and then hike and rappel down to the patient. We had about 7 agencies show up and approximately 40-plus people on the scene. Now, listening to this call, because it was operated on one of the channels that we can listen to, we heard them calling in for resources like the National Guard. They were calling for everybody. Now, I don't think the National Guard ever made it.
No, they didn't. I think the idea with the National Guard was they were going to do a hoist operation.
Yeah, exactly.
If they couldn't get the rope system to work as quickly. I mean, the patient was that critical or would have been justified.
Yeah. So one good idea is to call everybody and then call people off. That's kind of a persistent theme among any sort of a training operation is that you can always call people off, but you can't go back in time and wish you would have called in the National Guard.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
If they would have been the resource that made the difference in the operation.
Certainly. So one thing I really want to talk about on my sort of medical end of things is that I really wanted to give props to the main people handling the scene, which was Golden Fire.
Yeah, so a Golden Fire paramedic and an AMR paramedic were primary in the actual scene itself. And then Flight for Life's both flight medic and flight nurse assisted in kind of delivering instructions, and then they eventually did the final transport to the hospital.
Yeah, so one good thing is that they didn't decompress the patient's leg. They didn't get the patient completely unpinned until they had really the smartest people you could find on the scene. So they waited until the flight crew was there, and the flight crew administered heavy doses of benzodiazepines for sedation and meds to counteract a possible crush syndrome that this patient would have had. And being trapped for several hours, even isolated extremity like that, you definitely have a risk for a crush syndrome. So we're going to talk briefly about what you are going to want to do. So there's 3 main avenues that you need to address. You've got the acidosis that's going to be present in the patient's bloodstream when you release this. You're going to have the hyperkalemia, and then you're going to have the massive amounts of pain. So another good thing is that you want to tourniquet this this limb, because once you decompress, it's probably going to start bleeding profusely, and it's not a bad idea. They're already, you know, deprived of blood in those distal tissues, so putting on a tourniquet is always a good idea. The meds you want to use: sodium bicarb for the acidosis. Sodium bicarbonate is used as a buffer system. Technically, it's not really a countering of the acidosis directly, but it allows the body to kind of put a hold on the acidosis while the kidneys process the acid out. And then the hyperkalemia, you want to address that with calcium. So the calcium is going to make sure that the hyperkalemia doesn't kill the patient from a heart attack, from a cardiac arrest after the crush syndrome. Something most people aren't really thinking about on a trauma is cardiac arrest due to a chemical problem. So really, keep in mind that the way that we execute people by lethal injection, the only drug that actually kills them is the potassium. It's just straight up potassium chloride that kills them. Everything else helps the patient, or the, I guess not patients, convict.
Either way, it doesn't really matter.
Helps the convict go more peacefully. So but the potassium is what does the job. So when you talk about too much potassium, hyperkalemia, that's a serious medical condition. You can see that on a monitor by first you have a high peaked T wave. This is kind of your ALS level stuff. But you want to look for that high peak T wave, then you start to get a widening QRS complex. Wide QRS complexes are extremely bad. Get that calcium on board before you decompress them, pretty much directly before you decompress them.
Yeah, and that's part of the advantage of using the tourniquet is you can prevent that reperfusion injury from spreading to the rest of the body at the same time. And, I mean, it's extremely painful to reperfuse that tissue either way.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's probably actually better pain management to maintain that limb occlusion and keep blood flow from circulating down to it. On the actual rescue side, it was pretty cool to see how they ran this. This is kind of the worst-case scenario where I can't just take everything off of the truck, walk 10 feet to the vehicle that's pinning the guy, and just work using the hydraulic pump on the truck. That's fantastic. That's the way we like to do it on the highway. But we really can't do that when they're 100 feet up a hill and 100 feet down a cliff. So it was they hiked in a set of the Hurst hydraulic tools, a combination spreader cutter. One of the tools that they were going to use. And then they also hiked in a set of high-pressure airbags, which were what they ended up winning and succeeding at accomplishing rescue with. For those of you that don't know, the high-pressure airbag system works basically with, I put 20 pounds per square inch of air pressure into the bag, and I've got several dozen square inches of force, and so we just multiply that out, and I can get thousands of pounds of lifting force with not much air, and something pretty lightweight to carry in that doesn't require a power supply, and you just basically bring in a breathing air cylinder and you bring in a couple of airbags. They're fantastic for confined space work, for things like this where you're going to be hiking in a little way, all this kind of work. Airbags are definitely the way to go. We definitely used them in some of the extrication training we did underground because the expectation was we couldn't necessarily use a power saw because you start creating sparks. That's not a good time.
That's a bad
if you got flammable gases around. Mm-hmm. But airbags, no spark risk. Everything's good. No flammable. No heat produced in the process. It's an excellent way to go about it. Real props to these guys for doing a very good job being creative with the whole operation and making the rescue happen successfully. Overall, good work, guys. Our props to you. Wouldn't want to be it, but our props to you guys for doing a good job out there. All right, so moving on to our weekly gear review. We're going to talk about our, I guess, bi-weekly gear review. Thanks how we're doing this now.
Yeah.
Blackhawk CQB Riggers belt. Kind of a piece of everyday carry, everyday wear kind of gear that's also just fantastic for wearing while working. Made by Blackhawk, the guys who make a bunch of bags and clothing, and they make some holsters and things like that.
Oh, is it the same holster company?
Yeah. It's the same Blackhawk. The belt itself is kind of designed based on what was initially innovated by parachute riggers. That's why it's called the Riggers belt. They use scrap material left over from parachutes, etc., to make super high quality belts for themselves. And then everyone was like, dude, that's awesome. And they, you know, it's like, hey, can you make more? And some guys started making a lot of money after they patented it. Good work by them. Solid ingenuity. This belt is basically designed as a load-bearing belt. You thread through the buckle. It's not like it's ratcheting with a pin like most kind of dress belts are.
Yeah, and you see most people in EMS wearing this style of belt. So if you've seen someone who's been in EMS for a while or fire, and they're wearing a belt that has kind of a strange-looking clasp, not the typical pin system, it's the same sort of system. So
yeah, I mean, the webbing itself that makes up the main body of the belt has got a 7,000-pound tensile strength, which means that it's in the realm of what we use in rope rescue. The real nice thing about it is, I mean, there are other belts that meet that kind of spec, but this one, the actual attachment point is separated from the buckle. So the others, it's one solid kind of D-shaped piece. So when you clip into that, the whole thing pivots towards you, and all that weight is basically stabbing into your abdomen on a 2-inch by 1/4-inch piece of metal. And that's just terrible. It's uncomfortable. You never want to use the thing. It looks kind of cool, but it doesn't do the job. This belt also does the job. That's the nice thing. Yeah, so you got one of those.
You try and
load it, it's going to hurt.
See, I wouldn't
like
load
it
with this. I don't even know. I don't know if this is actually rated for climbing, so
yeah.
I don't think so.
So you get one of these, all right? This sucker is an awesome option. It's technically called as a Class 1 harness. So it's good as for emergency rappelling. It's like worst case scenario, you need to get out the window now, and this is the only thing to tie into. Or for low angle work. That's really the big advantage. Is you're going over the side, you don't need to put on a whole harness. If you're just going down a 45 degree slope and you don't want to fall, you do a little bit of a rappel using it. It's something to keep you from falling. It's a nice little travel restraint. Awesome option for that. And you know, putting on a whole harness for that's kind of goofy, but you know, whatever your policy is, follow your policy. Comfortable enough for everyday wear, and it actually looks pretty good as part of a uniform. You know, it's not what would be part of a Class A or Class B. You know, if we're being all dressy for some event, it's not your best option. Go with the nice polished leather, etc. But for, you know, day-to-day work, looks good. Strong enough that you can throw a bunch of gear on it. Firearms, if you're into carrying, you can carry easily with it. Ties nicely into a holster, even if you're doing loops and not going all the way into the pants or something like that. And the nice thing is they're not super expensive. You can get other rigging belts or rigger-style belts that are equally as well-rated, have got great reviews, and are made by solid, reputable companies. Like 511 makes a good one. There are a few others from like true rope rescue companies. Yeah, but those are like $100+. And if you're spending $100 on a belt, I want to see what you spend like $1,000 on, because you know, I hope that watch is worth it. This belt, so the CQB Riggers belt from Blackhawk, between $40 and $50, depending on where you find it and what sale's going on that day. It's an awesome belt, solid recommend from me. The nice thing is they made a newer version with the Cobra buckle. So I don't know if you've heard of this. It's a rated, fancy, like 5,000-pound breaking strength kind of clipped together buckle, just like you would see on a seatbelt. Made of like milled aluminum, and it's designed where as it loads, it actually holds itself even better together.
Yeah.
Like so it's designed where it cannot open under load. Even if you hit both sides of the guy, it won't open up on you, which is pretty neat. That belt is more like $80. I haven't tested it personally. I haven't got around to buying one. So I have no idea if it's any good. But just the regular CQB Riggers belt from Blackhawk is awesome. Totally recommend it. You know, it's a good option to go out and get. If you're looking for a new uniform belt, or you got some equipment budget to spend or a uniform allowance to spend, it's a great option. All right, so moving on, we'll talk about really today, talk shift programs for volunteer fire departments, and then we're going to talk about a news article that came out with NPR a little earlier this week. First, shift programs. I know a lot of volunteer fire departments have been focused on you simply just run calls when you're available. It's kind of the classical model for volunteer fire.
Yeah, and you have to make like 13% or
yeah,
something.
You shoot for some percent. Yeah. You shoot for, you know, we want to try and get you on a certain number of calls a year or something like that.
Well, what's Genesee do? They do like 13%.
Yeah, I think so.
15, something like that.
You know, other departments are in the 20s of percents. Others are fewer. You know, depending on how many calls they get, et cetera. You know, a department that gets only 100 calls a year, 20% of the calls really isn't too hard to make.
No, it's not so bad.
Realistically, I mean, it's 2 a month, and that's not so bad. So that's not necessarily a bad option. But the problem is people have day jobs. You've got a day job, and they can't let you go from your day job to go out and do fire stuff. That can become problematic.
Unless you have a really cool day job.
Yeah, you get a cool boss, that's the way to go. The other problem is you don't get a lot of time to hang around the station. I know it's always the classic, oh, what do you guys do? You're just playing Xbox the whole time. It's like, yeah, I mean, the television is on, the recliners are nice, but there is definitely a lot of other very important work that happens, and a lot of that is building crew cohesion. So it's you spend time hanging around with the guys that you're expected to go run calls with. You're going to do a better job running calls, most likely. So that's a problem with the non-shift volunteer system, really, is that you're not spending time with the guys. And you show up on a scene, you don't necessarily know how everyone's going to act, how everyone works, what their mannerisms are, and all that. So it's definitely a motivator to switch to a shift program for fire departments. So you build that team cohesion. The other big thing is you get a lot more training time. So you're spending an 8-hour shift at the firehouse, and you're not going to spend the whole time cleaning. You're not going to spend the whole time checking trucks. I mean, you can check trucks for 8 hours if you want, but I don't think you'll accomplish anything after the second one. But the other thing you can do is you can do much more complicated, much longer trainings. You can spend time really diving into something cool. You know, you got some guy who's super into extrication. You spend the whole time just going through all the tools and working on everything. You got someone who's super into cardiology. You spend the whole time, you spend like 30 minutes talking about like one reason to get this one rhythm. And that's awesome training time that you just don't get if you're not running a shift. The other big motivator is a shortened response time.
Yeah, and you have the shortened response time. In addition, you have the possibility of picking up members that are further away from your district. So up here at Highland Rescue, we operate almost entirely on a shift system. We have shift requirements. We have no sort of call requirements or anything like that. The people who are in district, the only nice thing about being in district is that we allow people to respond from their home while they're on shift. So it's kind of similar to being a non-shift system. You just know that you have to get this call if it's in the next 12 hours. So I live down the hill. I don't live in district. Most of our people don't live in district. I think we've got half a dozen total that live in our district with us. And without a shift system, we would not be able to operate. It would be absolutely impossible. So it helps that you can bring people up from other places and you get all those untapped resources, you know. Not every district is going to have enough firefighters or enough EMTs or enough paramedics or so on and so forth to support an EMS system. And what's kind of nice is that since we're on a shift system, you know, we're in the ambulance ready to roll usually before they're done dispatching. And you can't match that with volunteer. Or I'm sorry, with a non-shift volunteer.
Correct,
you can't match that.
We get a 60-second turnout time or so.
Yeah.
I mean, even if we're real generous in waking up, putting pants on, walking to the truck, it's still a 60-second turnout time.
Exactly.
When they complete toning us out. Versus a 20-minute or so response time that you can see if this district was covered by volunteers who didn't necessarily cover a station.
Yeah, and if as from like the officer's perspective, I know who's coming.
Yeah.
I don't have this question as to am I going to get response or not. You know, I don't have to think about who's in the district today.
Yeah.
Oh, it's noon on a Tuesday. Nobody's in my district.
Or it's, you know, we've got the two retired guys.
Yeah.
And we're relying on them to do all of the work. Which,
yeah, that's right.
You know, it's awesome that guys are getting after it, even, you know, 70, 80 years old. But we need more than two people. Most of the time to run a 911 call.
Did we lose record?
I don't know. Still rolling? Maybe? Oh, yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good
we
news.
We had a small glitch.
Yeah, that's awesome. We'll just leave that in. That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
All right, so risks to shift program.
Yeah.
This is where it gets interesting.
Now, actually, a perspective I just got recently. We have one of our neighboring fire departments runs off of a similar sort of system. They're required to do so many hours per year of shift. And so I was talking to someone who's a member here and a member at our at a neighboring district. And he was talking about how they don't have requirements per month, which we'll go into how Highland works. They just have the yearly. He's going to be done with his requirements come June.
Yeah.
And he really feels like, he's like, I'm going to be gone. Like, he's just going to take off. And that's, he doesn't want to... You know, that's going to be it for him. He's been working so hard. He's been working, you know, doing his duties over there, doing his duties here, that he's pretty much going to give no time to his fire department the second half of the year. And that's really rough for a fire department. Here, what our requirements are not per year. It's three shifts a month. Now, technically, here, the rules say it's nine shifts a quarter. And so you can get away with, we let you borrow one or from before and or after a month so you can work four and then one and then four, but
like,
generally people, I just, you know, we say three a month, you know, three 12-hour shifts a month, and because if I ran it the way that that our other fire department does, I mean, I can't have people going as like, well, my hours are done, chief, what, you know, you're not gonna, so
yeah,
you can't force me to work more shifts, and I'd end up in November
just
with
complete short staffing.
Yeah.
But you see, the opposite problem actually happens, too.
Oh,
the guys will slack off the first half of the year and be like, yeah, I'll pick up more shifts later. I'll pick up shifts during the summer. And then they don't. And then December is a madhouse for guys trying to cram all of their required time
and then,
into you know, 1 month. And it just doesn't work.
And it's rough because as a volunteer department, you don't... It's not so much like a job where it's like, okay, we'll get your shifts in or you're fired. In a certain sense, we have to use a lighter touch because you don't want to just lose your volunteers. Because there's a certain amount of, well, we kind of need them more than they need us.
Yeah.
Generally, if you make it difficult on people to volunteer, you find yourself with no volunteers. So even if the people are trying to scramble for their December and then they come to the end of the year and they didn't make their requirements, you don't have a large course of action.
Yeah.
There's some disciplinary action, but if you use too big of a hammer on people, they're just going to leave.
Yeah. So, you know, another major risk that we've seen in both our department and a couple other departments nearby is you don't have availability for large incidents. So we get some big, bad snowstorm or some other department gets a good, big wildfire. If they're used to being shift only, you necessarily... be awfully nice if I had a dozen people in the district who were available and that was what they were used to, and when they hear the big call, we fill all the trucks, it's great, and we have a great time, versus everyone's some large incident happens. And that's been expressed as a fear in a lot of departments of why they're so hesitant to move to more of a shift-based program, or even doing a combination. You know, shifts count as a number of credits of calls.
Yeah,
towards
so you can do
your
hybrid.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like you pull 3 shifts a month, totaling 8 or 12 hours of shift time, or however you want to do it. And then based on the number of hours of shift time, that gets factored in as number of calls, and you still meet your call requirement.
Are you guys
that way.
Still doing like 8 to 1?
Yeah, it's 8
yeah.
to 1
yeah.
up
okay.
Up north. So that's how I've been scheduling, as I'll do an 8-hour shift and 2 4-hour shifts. Or I'll do like a 6-hour shift and an 8-hour and a 4-hour.
8 to 1
like
meaning 8 hours equals 1 call. Now
yeah.
That works at a very small rural department. Obviously, you know, well, West Met's not even a volunteer, but
yeah.
West Met, 8 hours, 1 call, that's
just a complete
that's
waste.
That's a tenth of a percent.
Yeah.
You know, you're not even going to come, you're not going to make a dent.
Yeah.
That.
So let's talk how to implement a shift program and what actually kind of goes into the process. The big thing is this is a pretty slow process, and often it just takes someone deciding, hey, let's start to do more shifts. Let's organize it a little bit. Let's really make this kind of happen. And that's a lot of the time how things kind of get started, is you get members who are interested in doing shifts, and then more members are interested in doing shifts, and then we figure out how to make shifts equivalent with whatever credit system. And it's a kind of a piece-by-piece process that you go in kind of slow motion for. The big thing is define an SOP for shift operations early. Take the time, write the policy. Just because you've been doing something one way for a given amount of time, tradition is not policy. You need to write something down and figure it out. Once you've figured out what actually needs to happen as part of a shift, everything gets a lot easier. So you get something written down, check 2 trucks or something like that. You know, you make that a shift requirement. So particularly at a volunteer fire department where the rigs aren't getting checked, you got a dozen rigs you got to worry about, we make sure that they get checked. We make sure members stay up to date on their skills and physical fitness stays up and guys are getting after it and really doing a good job taking care of themselves while they're on shift also.
I think we need to implement that up here.
I agree. I mean, something we're working on at Golden Gate, we're going to put in a weight rack. We're going to build a power rack. We're going to get it all squared away. So, I mean, we can hike. We got tons of trail, and we got all kinds of space to go do that. We can do cardio, and we can do weights. And we'll actually be able to do proper exercise on shift. And that's really going to, I think, motivate people. It's an opportunity
that
to come up, and it builds camaraderie also. Is, you know, the guys you hang around and lift with and cook with and throw darts at a dartboard and hit the wall with, etc., are guys you tend to work with better and get along with better. And it's really a good time, and it makes the department, I think, overall better.
Yeah, I could get behind that.
You know, there's an awful lot of benefit, I think, to an effective and well-run shift program.
Yeah.
So, shifts, something to think about, good option out there. especially for the volunteer fire department that having trouble getting members and having them stick around. It's a good option to think and something to work on. All right. So
there was an article posted this week by NPR, actually, published on NPR, that was titled Why Send a Fire Truck to Do an Ambulance's Job? And this is largely some flack that Chicago Fire has been coming under.
The station dog is making some noise and scratching at some doors. It's all right.
Yeah. She'll learn. So I want to be clear that I in no way am trying to directly criticize Chicago Fire or any specific fire department. But I think we have some systemic issues in the fire EMS world, and specifically where those blend, where those come together, and where maybe they should be separate, in my opinion. And I by no means mean any disrespect to Chicago Fire in general, specifically. I think this is a problem that goes pretty deep and goes into every major city, particularly. You know, Los Angeles is where I have experiences. I interned with Los Angeles City Station 62 in Venice Beach, and something I definitely experienced there. Every major city, at least in America, has this problem, in my opinion. And what it is that they're coming under fire because they run...
Yeah, under fire.
Ah, God, I did it again.
Yeah.
I did this earlier, too.
Yeah.
Unintentional pun. So they've got a lot of bad press right now because what they have been doing is that... we'll talk about what is causing this problem then, in my opinion, where it all started. Chicago Fire rolls ALS engines, which I think is kind of a goofy concept, but the idea is that...
ALS engines as a concept.
I will talk about why I think it's goofy. Isolated a paramedic on an engine. I will never say a paramedic anywhere is a bad idea. Paramedics belong everywhere. However, they'll roll this ALS engine to a medical call, and the ambulance will not show up for a while afterwards.
What does a while mean? Are we talking 2 minutes? Are we talking 5 minutes? Are we talking 30 minutes?
We're talking, in some cases, excess of 10 minutes, which is unacceptable in an emergency response. Okay. Now, this is... It depends, obviously, and you're going to find some trials where... You know, excess of 30 minutes, and then you're going to find trials where it was in excess of 30 seconds. But the concept of why they're catching all this flack is because the ALS engine shows up, and then there's delay before the ambulance shows up. Now, one thing I think the public may have gotten a little bit wrong is that it's not like they dispatch the engine and just the engine to this call.
Absolutely, it's not a fire can handle it. Yeah. Kind of thought.
Yeah, exactly. That's not the problem here. Nobody dispatches just an engine to what is probably going to be a transport to the hospital.
Yeah.
We don't throw them on the hose bed and think that's sufficient. But they roll this ALS engine, which has got at least one paramedic on it, and in my experience, at least in LA, you could throw a rock in a room full of firefighters and not... And you couldn't miss the paramedics.
Oh, and that's because...
Okay, their paramedics were everywhere.
Yeah. It's just the way the system was kind of set up.
Exactly. We'll
EMTs can't
that.
Do anything in California anyway.
Well,
so.
Or in Illinois, as long as I understand. And pretty much in any major city, and I think Denver's kind of unique in this way, is they let the EMTs do a lot. But EMTs are really just drivers with O2. They throw O2 on them, and then they step on that skinny pedal on the right. And that's all the EMTs do. That's a real shame.
Come on, dog.
All right. So they're coming under. They've got a lot of problems from the public because of this response system, and I really think that what this stems from is that in the early days of EMS, in the earliest days of this concept of
Johnny
medical,
and Roy,
even pre Johnny and Roy, we're talking about the earliest concepts of putting field workers, medical people in the field of some sort. They started out by sending doctors and or nurses into the field. They throw them in a hearse with the hearse-bulance, my favorite little portmanteau, the hearse-bulance. And they throw a doctor and a nurse, and then later, like, a couple of nurses who had some extra training. into a car, and then they sent him out there to be medical people. And that was a great idea. And frankly, I think they gave up on that a little bit early, in my opinion. I think we should have run with that concept instead of what really happened was that there was this problem with the nurses really not being comfortable. And this is in the field.
So
they didn't know the city. And, you know, this is obviously pre-GPS.
Mm-hmm.
This is pre-even really good map books existed, because map books were largely spearheaded by fire departments and things like that. So this was the big map
on the wall, and you got to figure out where you're going.
Exactly, and you got like a grid,
which
was super cool. But, you know, these nurses did not know the city very well. You know, you knew your neighborhood, and you knew how to get to work and how to get to a couple places. But that's it. Realistically, back then, how much of your city did you know? So you had these nurses, they would go out there and they'd be dealing with things that in the field we deal with different problems. I don't want to say our problems are worse or better than what they deal with in the hospital, but they're very different. When you're in a hospital, you got this controlled environment, you have to keep the patient alive for a lot longer. You know, the acute versus continuous care there's a huge chasm in there. Because of this discomfort that these nurses were going under. And I also mean no disrespect to nurses past or present, but they were not comfortable in this situation. Doctors, nurses, they weren't comfortable in this situation. So what they did, the people who got together and kind of spearheaded EMS, is they took a very logical step and said, let's have fire do it. Because the firemen know the cities, they drive around fast in big scary vehicles to get to places to put out fires and, you know, do technical rescues. Very good at that. And so it makes sense to just, all right, now it's a different kind of emergency. They go there, and now they take them to the hospital. And frankly, at least where we are now, I think that's maybe where we went wrong, is because my paramedic instructor, Mr. Brian Wheeler at UCLA, told me once that there is so much that a firefighter has to know, and there is so much that a paramedic really should have to know, that it's inconceivable to be perfect at both. You can really expect a man to have a high degree of excellence in one of them, in medicine or in fire. And that's always kind of stuck with me, is that when I was interning, the protocols in LA did not allow for a lot of real medicine to be done. It was very kind of cookie cutter, it was very formulaic, and in my experience, most big cities work this way. And I think it's out of necessity, because these firemen, a lot of them, they join the fire department to be firemen. Most of them don't join the fire department to be paramedics. And when the department needs more paramedics all the time, because the fire departments have prevented themselves out of the job. Fires, structural fires don't happen nearly as much as they used to. So these firemen are encouraged to go to paramedic school. They are either shanghaied into it, which a large percentage of my paramedic class was shanghaied, and then almost all of the rest of them were there really just for the pay raise.
Yeah.
And that's, again, I mean no disrespect, a pay raise is a great thing, but that's not why you should get into medicine. You should never get into medicine for a reason like that. So they were excellent firemen. And let me tell you, I got to watch them work two structure fires. And to say that they were a well-oiled machine is a understatement. They were amazing at what they did. It was my first real experience with fire. My first first-hand experience with firemen doing what firemen should be doing. But the medicine was lacking, in my opinion. And I met a couple of people there that were really good paramedics. But they were almost ostracized for it. I think this blend of fire and EMS, or fire and medicine really, is something that maybe should not have happened or should have happened differently. So when I see Chicago Fire come under criticism for this running an ALS engine onto a scene, I tend to want to side with the criticism, saying, well, you shouldn't be running an engine to do an ambulance's job. And there are some scenes that are definitely what you need is transport. You need rapid transportation. There are the scenes where you get a paramedic on scene. That's always great, because even if it's going to take a while to get an ambulance to him, the paramedic can start some work. But stroke, heart attack, severe trauma, we can't fix any of those things.
No. Well,
we can't. The heart attack, maybe we got a little bit better, more stuff than the other two. But stroke and trauma, minutes, seconds count.
So if it's still going to take 9 minutes for an ALS ambulance to get on scene, which is kind of the national standard performance time for EMS to arrive on scene. So 9 minutes for box to get there. If I can get fire there in 2 minutes and they can hand you 2 12 leads, a dose of ASA, maybe a dose of nitro, 2 large bore IVs, and all you have to do is transport and call the STEMI alert, what more do you need to do? Where's the problem?
Now, of course, that is where I say having paramedics places is not the problem here.
Yeah.
I love having paramedics places. But what I think is we have a systemic issue where we don't have enough boxes running around. We don't have enough ambulances
running
around. And what it is, you know, when a fire department gets $1 billion from the state, they don't buy $1 billion of ambulances.
No, God no. They're
and
less
frankly,
fun. They're
and you know we can make fun of them and say, well, they like the bigger trucks because we're all just little kids. You know, worker in EMS I've ever met is just basically a 4-year-old boy, men and women alike.
This you know, big red truck with makes a lot of noise.
Exactly,
it's
you love it.
That simple.
They don't allocate their funds appropriately to their call volume. So say they're 80-20. Say they're 80%. Medical, 20% fire. The funds don't go 80-20.
No.
I guarantee you that. That's not even close. And that's where we have our problems. It's not that, of course, I show up on a scene 10 minutes after dispatch. I have a patient with 2 large bore IVs, 2 12 leads, and ALS drugs on board already. Of course, I'm a very happy medic.
Yeah, that's
okay?
A good day
but
for
what I'd
people.
Rather have is have that guy already at the hospital before within those 9 minutes.
Well, in people in hell want ice water, but it's a decent way to manage the resources, I think, because currently we run into the ragged edge of you run an engine crew of 3 in a career in most suburban systems. Engine crew of 3 is really not a lot.
No,
it's
that's
enough for
really
it's enough for a medical, a crew of 3, and then the ambulance that shows up with an additional 2. The problem is you start to reduce resources for the big incident that really needs them. Where I understand we're spending 80% of our effort we spend 80% of our budget doing 20% of our work.
Yeah.
And vice versa, we do 80% effort and 20% budget.
Yeah.
But it's that extra 20% that is what defines an excellent department as opposed to a subpar department. Just because you can throw someone into an ambulance, give a few drugs, and get them to the hospital doesn't necessarily make the department fantastic. It's the ability to handle the oddball call of, you know, someone gets pinned under a semi and the semi's on fire. If I can get enough resources to the scene that are properly equipped, as in they're not in utilities, they're not in ambulances, if I get engine companies and rescue companies and ambulances to the scene, that's the best case scenario. I guess the overall moral of the story is increase funding for public safety.
Yeah,
I think
across the board.
Everything has become too expensive. But it's all in how we effectively manage those resources. So I actually think that the ALS engine is a great way to do it, where you can at least bridge some of the gap in the absence of that resource. Because we're using ALS ambulances to do BLS transports.
Now that's true. And there are bigger city systems in again, my experience comes from Los Angeles. So LA City runs both ALS and BLS ambulances. The BLS ambulances had the designation 800 blank. So if I had a BLS ambulance at my station, it would have been 862 as opposed to 62, which was the ALS ambulance that I was working on. My station was a relatively small station, had an ALS ambulance, so we were we called it Rescue 62, which I realize now that confuses other departments thoroughly because I came out here.
Rescue company's got the power saws and the tools
exactly.
on it. It's the toolbox on wheels.
They call it Rescue 62. So we had Engine 62 and we had Rescue 62. Our engine was an ALS engine. In the house, there were six people. Seven because of me. But 6 people in that house. Captain, engineer, firefighter, who was just an EMT, and then 3 paramedics. The paramedics on a set of 3 shifts rotated through. So you work 2 shifts on the ambulance and 1 on the engine. Again, what I consider this, put paramedics on the engine, by all means, but what we need is more ambulances. And in my opinion, rolling the ALS engine to the scene and going that helps and that's good. That you're right, it does help. But what you're doing is you're putting a Band-Aid on an arterial bleed. It looks like it's solving the problem, and it sort of placates people who, you know, look, we're putting ALS resources on scene. But the calls that really matter, we don't need ALS resources on scene. We need ALS resources on scene with a transport vehicle.
Well, and so this is where EMD can come in. Is so, you know, if we know it is a, you know, dispatcher gives the criteria, gives some Cincinnati questionnaire, we're getting positive Cincinnati feedback over the phone. I mean, of course, we're going to divert an ambulance that's going to a stubbed toe to go to that.
Yeah.
And then we make it work, we make it happen, we make that time count. But the advantage I see is in things like the classic unknown medical sick case, the who knows what, where, you know, it's not an EMD critical call, but it's not a definitively BLS, no, not, you know, complete nonsense call. If I can get a paramedic on scene with an engine 5 minutes before an ambulance gets there, because who knows, they're coming from the other side of the city, something's going on, and we're just short resources. If they can at least initiate treatment, get the assessment done, and if they're able to step it down, and we can confirm that it's actually a BLS call, or they can take over the call and transport with the BLS
crew. With the BLS engine, yeah.
These options,
the BLS ambulance.
Yeah, I mean, these options all exist, and I think it's a useful tool to make things happen. But I definitely don't think that it makes sense to maintain the same about 80-20 budgeting nightmare.
Now, it's true that whereas, and I do want to address that, I don't sound too ignorant, engines are maybe required on 20% of the calls. But man, you really want an engine on that 20%.
Oh yeah, there's and, no you know, you there's no substitute for an
exactly.
engine on a
so,
call where you need an engine.
I realize that heavy rescue equipment, whereas needed very frequently, is extremely important and extremely expensive. So I'm not suggesting an 80-20% split on funding straight for the calls. I don't want to give the wrong impression here. I understand that fire equipment costs more than ambulances. And that there's going to be a gap there. But I think we're way too far on the side of buying fire equipment for medical departments. Now, what I'd really love to see is how we run things up here at Highland Rescue and Genesee Fire and Foothills Fire. We are the medical for two volunteer fire departments. And this may not work in big cities. I would go so far as to say currently it really would not work in big cities. But when you separate them and you make them two departments, kind of two heads of the same two- or three-headed, and the way that fire and police work together, as much as the jokes get thrown around, we're all brothers up here.
100%.
But if there was a third head on that monster, I would actually think that's a lot better, where EMS was kind of its own thing and not lumped in with fire.
Yeah.
That's my ideal situation. That's why I love working up here. And I'm going through fire training myself because I've become interested in fire recently.
Because it's actually
fun. That being said, well, it is fun.
I mean,
I have to say,
that's the big thing. Is it's a blast.
It is
to go and do something like, oh, we're going to convert this SUV into a convertible, and we can do it in 2 minutes.
Certainly,
it's
a lot of fun.
It's another stub toe.
Yeah. However, I do still think, even after I get my training here, I really do think that separation is the best way, and that's tough to sell to a city, because why would you pay two people to do what you can pay one person for? And there's no way to justify that. And that's where I say I think we got off track a long time ago, because there's too much inertia in the system for it really to change.
Well, so the interesting thing is you look internationally, and it's actually more of what we used of the old system. So in Germany, with a 911 call for medical assistance, a physician is dispatched from a hospital in addition to fire and EMS to do the transport.
Now, that's
a physician
actually,
is dispatched to respond to the incident.
That's a little different, and I'm not familiar with Germany, but I believe they run it the exact same way in the UK.
Yeah,
they've got
the National Health Service runs. Well, no, the physician goes in a fly car to basically all medical calls that are triaged as higher priority.
Exactly.
As opposed to the NHS helicopter option.
No, they
do
the
fly
UK
cars
too? Yeah,
okay.
They do the cars. They got a little little sports car, man. That's cool.
Not a sports car. It's a Ford Fiesta.
Oh, sometimes so.
Something
I've seen
terrible.
I've seen some nice little coupes.
In general, just to hate on the guys over the across the pond, all of their emergency response vehicles are far less fun than what we have.
They're too
here.
Small.
They're too small. I mean, we get Dodge Chargers here for the cops. What do they have? They have like Fiesta diesel.
I don't know. If you're in Dubai, you get the
all the confiscated cars.
You get the Lamborghinis. In the UK, what's cool is that you do get that physician, but they don't have really paramedics like we do in America.
Yeah, that's true.
They've got really just EMTs, and that's a shame to me because I think that obviously I've got a warped perspective on this. I am a paramedic, and so I want paramedics to have a higher scope of practice. But I really think paramedic school should be sort of how they do it in Kings County in Seattle, where the paramedics are well above what we call the national registry right now.
Oh, yeah.
I think paramedics should do I-STATs and basic lab values. I'm not talking the weird stuff. I'm talking cardiac enzymes, CBC, chemistry, some basics. I want ultrasound. It's not that hard to teach someone how to do a fast exam.
No.
And once you've got the ultrasound in the ambulance, opens up a whole another possibility for treatment modalities. Think of a flight medic. I really think our base paramedics should be at that level. Chest tubes, some more ALS, more advanced level procedures done in the field. You know, a chest tube is way better than a needle thoracostomy. Needle thoracostomy is great for a pneumo. If you got a hemo, thoracostomy doesn't do junk. So that's kind of my final word on it, is that we should be training paramedics to higher levels than they are right now and then separate them from fire. That's my own personal opinion on that.
I don't know. I'm still a fan of the fire-based EMS system. I see there's a lot of advantage in combined overhead, combined operations, where you know all the guys that you're going to be showing up with, you're all at the same station, and everyone has overall a higher level of training. Because how many certs is it to work in an EMS agency? Two.
Well, no, that's a paramedic.
As an EMT, it's two certs. As a paramedic, how many is it? Three?
Base.
Certs to maintain.
Yeah, so you need state.
Yep.
You still need CPR.
Yep.
BLS.
BLS.
ACLS.
Okay. There's
PALS.
Three. Four.
PHTLS.
Okay. Do you have to retest on PT or PHTLS?
Yes.
Okay. So five certs. All right. A fire medic has got an additional three certs on top of that.
So what's fire have on top of that?
You've got firefighter one minimum, probably fire two, which is a long class also. You've got hazardous materials. Because hazmat's cool, and you need to know hazmat.
Yeah.
We should be teaching hazmat to EMTs far more than we do now.
Just a basic level.
Oh, it's
yeah.
it's
we'll
unbelievable.
Talk about that in a future.
And third is wildland, at least out here. Everyone's got their
190. Inside,
because
but in the city.
Okay.
In the city, nobody rides wildland.
Denver, most guys
Denver's
have
130 a weird city.
Because
we've talked about how
people. Because they make money off of it.
We talked about how Denver's weird.
Okay? Right, so
I'm talking Chicago, Los Angeles, New York,
okay.
Boston.
You think Los Angeles doesn't serve in wildland?
They don't.
They're like
for a fact.
The wildland department.
It's L.A. County.
Oh, okay. Okay.
L.A. City does not.
So Johnny and Roy, not the other guys.
Yeah, Johnny and Roy was L.A. County.
Okay, fine. So county, their county medics are maintaining eight certs.
That's a lot of certs.
And you got a lot of guys with a lot of training. The advantage there is that you've got depth and breadth. So, there's none of this. There are no idle hands on the scene, theoretically, if it's something complicated or something that's a pain.
Yeah.
It's an extrication. You get the one guy who's taking care of the patient. The other guy on the ambulance can be still working on the extrication as opposed to standing around.
Yeah, and that's been the number one reason why I have pursued fire, is I got real sick of hands in my pockets when some fire was happening on my scene. Now, 20% doesn't happen often, but sometimes I'm sitting there waiting for the fireman to get the can opener and get this guy out of the car, and I'm sitting there going, well, patient's stable. I really wish there was something I could do. And then I wanted to go, so that's why I'm learning fire.
And it's the same on structure fire, wildfire, anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need we don't need extra crews hanging around who aren't doing work, with the exception of some sort of rehab unit. Set up rehab, two dudes on rehab, cool, whatever. Let's actually commit to solving the emergency. Mm-hmm. Of course, just to send to solve the emergency. Whatever the emergency is, I think overall the better. We pigeonhole people too much. If I don't get fire guys who are well-trained in EMS, they're worthless on a medical scene. If I don't have EMS guys who are well-trained in technical rescue or other just basic rescue disciplines, traffic control, or how to not get hurt on a complex scene, they're worthless.
Yeah.
I want fewer worthless people. I think that's a decent motto. I should make a t-shirt that says that. I want fewer worthless people.
And you have a point there. That being said, I really do think that specialization maybe should be encouraged more in this split, fire and medicine.
Yeah. I mean, you get the guys that are super into, you get the super hazmat dudes.
Yeah.
You get the super cardiac dudes. You get the super trauma dudes, etc. And that's all good. Good for you. But be good at the rest of your job and be able to at least do something. There's no reason to be not doing anything on a scene, realistically. Otherwise, you're not needed on the scene. You can clear.
Yeah.
Well, I think fire-based EMS versus
just
fire
keep hitting
separate
that with a hammer
EMS,
for days.
That's probably going to be a recurring theme in this podcast.
That's
certainly a conversation Chris and I have all the time.
It's a routine argument. It's almost comedic these days.
Yeah.
I think that's all I got for tonight.
That's all we got. Feel free to leave us any comments. You think that we're full of it, and you think that you like what we are talking about, any suggestions for gear or anything like that, just drop us a line.
So up on Facebook is Rescue Junkies Training. Also up on iTunes now. We got our iTunes approval. So as soon as I upload this to SoundCloud tomorrow, it'll automatically upload to iTunes. So if you like what you see, rate us, write a review, do something like that. If you like what you hear, do the same thing too. Get into it. Get after it. We also have the option to donate if you're interested. We are on, it's not Kickstarter, it's the GoFundMe, because GoFundMe will just take donations continuously versus Kickstarter does not. Kickstarter is give a 60-day period maximum. It's like, it's no fun. So find us online, donate us, support the podcast if you're interested. Have fun, be safe, do a good job. Talk to you later.
Keep training.